As we embark upon the period of the 9 days, and in particular the Avelus, the morning of Yushalayim, the question that we need to ask ourselves, the question that Rav Nebenzal asked in Sichos L'Parshat HaShavua, is Alma Be'etzem Mit'ablim. What in essence are we mourning for? What is this whole mourning period with all the strictures that are placed on us and the intense mourning period of Tisha B'Av? What is it all about? What is the Avelus? How do we characterize, how do we define what exactly are we mourning for? This is the key question in understanding the mindset and understanding our Avodas Hayom and understanding what our service of God is all about during these 9 days and during Tisha B'Av. It's a question of Ma Be'etzem Mit'ablim. What are we mourning for? What is the whole character of this time? And I'd like to try to develop Mirtz Hashem today an approach that perhaps gives us a sense on one level of what the mourning period of the 9 days and in particular of what Tisha B'Av is about. We begin with the essay of Rav Nebenzal. He says very clearly, it's really not a question of mourning about a building that was, once was, or mourning about the fact that this building had Kedusha that is no longer. Because we know, as the Rambam tells us, Shekedushas Mekom HaMikdash Eina B'Teila La'olam, the Kedusha, the holiness of Yushalayim, of the place of the Beis HaMikdash, the place of the Shechina, is Eina B'Teila, can never be nullified. There still exists the same intense Kedusha as once was. And in the real sense, our rabbis tell us that there's a Beis HaMikdash Lamala, there's a Beis HaMikdash above that was never destroyed. A Beis HaMikdash that on some level, difficult for us to understand, is still functioning, alive and well up in Shemayim. It's not a question about the loss of the Beis HaMikdash below, of the Kedusha that was lost down here. That is to understand the Avelus, the morning of Yushalayim, of Tisha B'Av, on a very narrow level. Says Rav Nebenzal, what we are mourning for is much deeper than that. What we're mourning for is something that we have indeed lost, something that we need to work on regaining. And he describes it in a wonderful mashal of our rabbis who describe the loss of tzaddikim. When tzaddikim die, it's like losing a precious stone. We know when a precious stone is lost, so there's no change really in the preciousness of the stone. Wherever the stone is found, it still is precious. The value is still there. The only thing that has changed, the only thing that is lost, is the owner who now has lost this precious stone. What has changed in the destruction of Yushalayim, to Yushalayim nothing really happened. The Beis HaMikdash is still functioning up in heaven. What has changed? Lo Yushalayim hi shecharva. It's not Yushalayim that's destroyed. Anu chervanu. It's been us who've been destroyed. That's the mindset of what Tisha B'Av is about. Not to focus all our focus on a building that once was, but to put the focus in on ourselves. We who are the Baal Margalit, we are the ones who are the owner of this precious stone. We are the one who is suffering the loss. The loss is really not in the stone itself. It has not changed its value. It is us, the owners of this stone, who are suffering. And he explains so beautifully the Gemara in Yerushalmi and Yuma that says that in any generation that the Beis HaMikdash is not rebuilt in its time, ki iluhi chervo, it's as if that generation has destroyed it. Explains Rav Nebenzal, the reason is because it's not just the question of rebuilding a building. The question is, the only way to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash is to rebuild ourselves. Ki mi mana mimcha liznot et atzmecha. And who's stopping you from building yourself? Why, we're held accountable in every generation. If the Beis HaMikdash isn't rebuilt in our generations, as if we destroyed it. Because the building of the Beis HaMikdash is not just building a physical building of stones and bricks. The building of the Beis HaMikdash is building the owner of the Beis HaMikdash. It's building the essence of the Beis HaMikdash. It's the people that make really the Beis HaMikdash. And nobody's stopping you from building yourself. If you haven't built yourself, if you haven't worked on yourself as a generation to be ra'ui, to be worthy of having the Beis HaMikdash, so then, which is definitely in our hands, it's as if we destroyed it. And therefore, says Rabbi Neben Zal, ha'avelut b'yamim elu, the mourning at this time, hi amatzavenu haruchani, is on our spiritual status. This is a type of mourning that we can change and we can do something about it. It's a type of mourning that has to be not only the negative aspect of what we've lost, but there has to be a positive element of how we can build, how we can grow, how we can change from this mourning. And that's the key. The key to understanding the Beis HaMikdash, and it's the key that the first Beis HaMikdash they didn't understand so well. The people would do terrible atrocities and come to the Beis HaMikdash, and they thought the Beis HaMikdash would save them. As Yirmiyah HaNavi says, Uvatem v'amartem lefanai v'bayit hazeh v'amartem nitzolnu. They would do terrible things, and they'd come to the Beis HaMikdash, and they feel they were saved. It's not the physical building that's going to save you. The physical building is but a representation of the spiritual level of the people. And this is what we have to ask ourselves during the 3 weeks and 9 days in Tisha B'Av, is where is our spiritual level? The mourning is over where we have lost our spiritual statuses, how we need to work on ourselves and change ourselves. And he says, why is this so difficult? Because ki kasheh la'adam l'shaper et atzmo, because it's hard for a person to fix himself. It's hard for a person to break out of one's habits. It's hard for a person to leave the world of the externalities. And we basically say to ourselves, you know what, we've gone along very nicely without a Beis HaMikdash. We've gone along very nicely without Karbanos. It's been thousands of years. You know what really interferes with our lives? It's these 3 weeks that interfere with our lives. And during the summer months, no less, during our vacation, it has to come in and mess up our lives. Kol od hamikdash eino banui, oti sha'am eino banui. As long as the temple is not rebuilt, it's a sign that we have not rebuilt ourselves. We have not taken the message of what the Avelus, the morning of Yerushalayim, is all about. The morning of Yerushalayim is about rebuilding ourselves. The morning of Yerushalayim is about how we as a people have to change and rebuild our relationship with God, to be worthy for that spiritual structure to return down to earth. And that's how he concludes his essay so beautifully. Where we know the Shulchan Aruch begins talking about Tikkun Chatzos, the morning at midnight for Jerusalem. So the Shulchan Aruch says, Ra'ui l'chol yirei shamayim, it's proper for all those who fear heaven, Shem meitzer v'do'eg al churban Beit HaMikdash, to worry and to be concerned about the Beit HaMikdash. And the question that's asked is, why is this halacha, this law, only relegated to Yirei Shamayim, people who fear heaven? Should it not be on every individual? So an approach that's given, and it's the approach we're speaking about today, those who have Yirei Shamayim, who fear heaven, can cry over a korban. One who is not on that level, do you know what he needs to cry about? Ra'ui shivkeh kodem kol al atzmo. He should cry about himself. Because Misha Adain Lo Banat Asmo, one who has not yet rebuilt himself, Ketzad Yuchal Bichlal Lifnot Mikdash, how can he build the Beis HaMikdash? This is perhaps the bedrock, the key of the morning of Tisha B'Av. The morning of Tisha B'Av is not on necessarily a building that once was, not on a Kedusha, holiness once was, but it's very much relevant to our lives. The mourning of Yerushalayim is a mourning over our own spiritual status, which is very much alive and functioning today. And it's this spiritual status that we need to mourn, of how distant we are and how much we need to rebuild ourselves in order to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. The Avelus of Tisha B'Av is an Avelus of mourning over our spiritual status, and the process of beginning to regenerate, of making commitments to change that, to begin rebuilding already now those bricks in the spiritual Beis HaMikdash. The question we have to ask ourselves is how, is what. In what area do we need to work on ourselves, and what area do we need to begin rebuilding this loss and feeling this loss? So perhaps one key is a very beautiful medrash that's found in the Psikta. The Psikta is based on a pasuk in Hosea which says, "Vehema ka'adam avru brit." They, like man, have broken the covenant. Says the Psikta, as quoted by Rabbi Breuer in his book Chochma Musar, such is the prophet's complaint about Israel. The expression man, according to the sages, here refers to the first man created. God proclaims, "I brought the first man in the Garden of Eden, and I revealed my will to him. He did not obey my commands. I punished him by expulsion and exile, and I mourned over him. For so it says, God exiled man. God let man go. And he said to him, Ayeka, where are you?" The letters of the word Ayeka can also be read as Eicha, the lamentation. His descendants, continued the Medrash, "I brought to Eretz Israel and revealed my will to them, but they violated it, and I punished them also by expulsion and exiled, and I mourned over them. For so it says, I expelled them from my house, banned them from my countenance in order that they should part. How it, the people, now dwell in loneliness. Eicha." Rabbi Breuer notes that the word of wisdom draws a parallel between the account of the first human pair and the history of the Jewish people. Here and there, the same fate, both caused by the same circumstances, where God created the Garden of Eden on earth for the first human pair. Its earthly bliss was to be enhanced by the most intimate proximity for God. There was only this obligation of an unconditional obedience to divine will, which was not heeded. And therefore we know there was a physical expulsion from the Garden of Eden. And Rabbi Breuer continues, "It was to be Israel's task to guide mankind on this path. Therein lies the lofty, divinely appointed task of the Jewish people. The land of Israel was to become its rejuvenated Gan Eden, and the sanctity of its way of life was to create a renewed home for God's Shekhinah on earth. But tragedy interfered here also, when Israel proceeded to refuse obedience to the precepts of the divine will." And we have the same concept of the renewed Siluk HaShechina as God's Shechina left the human circle for a second time. Far from the Garden of Eden, God's land, far from God's countenance, the Jewish people was to prepare for its lofty task in and through the exile. We see here so clearly a parallel between the first man who was planted in the Garden of Eden, who had such closeness to God, who rebelled, and who was expelled. The Jewish people had a chance to redo and recorrect that which was done wrong in the first place. Again, this closeness to God. Again, the land of Israel, the Garden of Eden. And again, the rebellion. And again, the expulsion. The double tragedy of its fate, continues Rabbi Breuer, is expressed with incomparable brevity and intensity in the one word Eicha, with its two different ways of punctuation. Eicha views the present desperate situation of the Jewish people as compared to its former glory, and measures its present poverty and humiliation against its former wealth and greatness. Eicha yashva badad, how it dwells now in loneliness. And then you have the word Ayeka, where are you? On the other hand, is the angry inquiry by the Shekhinah as it leaves the human sphere. The question was to make man fully conscious of the scope of his erring ways. Where are you? Where has your folly and delusion brought you? Eicha and Ayeka denote the twofold character of the fate that our gullet had brought over, and which is the object of our plaint, of our mourning. In the inseparable unity of these two concepts, we find the great truth we have to realize in our lives if an end is to be put to our gullet misery. As long as we remain guilty of the angry reproach of the Ayeka, which places on us responsibility of the Shekhinah Galut, the Eicha misery of our national suffering will not cease. Year after year, these weeks are devoted to the mourning over the Ayeka, where are we, of our estrangement from God's proximity. This, my friends, is really the key. And this is re-echoing what Rav Nebenzahl said. When we sit on the floor and hear Eicha, when four out of the five chapters begin with this word of Eicha, the Balei Musar speak about what we should be hearing is not only the word Eicha, the lamentation, but we should be hearing the word Ayeka, where are we? The word Ayeka that was given to the first man is the word that resounds throughout history as we have the Siluk HaShchina, as we have God departing from our midst. Where are we? Where are we is the question we need to ask ourselves. The mourning over Yerushalayim has to be coupled with the Eicha, the lamentation, has to be coupled with Ayeka, where do we stand? What are we mourning about? Where are we in this picture? Where are our spiritual barometer? If we can respond to the question of Ayeka, of where are we, we've begun now to give comfort to the Eicha, to the lamentation. This is the question that we need to ask ourselves. This is the question of what Tisha B'Av is about. You want to have an understanding of Eicha Yashva Badad, how have we sat all by ourselves? First begin to respond to Ayeka, where are we? But the question still remains, what is the answer to this Ayeka? What is the question that God is asking us when we hear over and over again, Ayeka, Ayeka, where are you, where are you? So I think that there are two approaches that we can take today. The first, very briefly, and the second I'd like to develop, of what we need to hear in the words Eicha and Ayeka. The first is the Leket Sichos Musar and Slobodka Rosh Yeshiva, who speaks about when we hear Eicha and Ayeka, we should ask ourselves, how is it possible that we've lost Eretz Yisrael? How have we lost the opportunity to mamish be in the Gan Eden, where the Sharei Shamayim were open in front of us when we had the Beis HaMikdash? How is it possible that we've fallen to such a level where we no longer have this relationship with God, this relationship with miracles? And on this level, when we sit on Tisha B'Av and we mourn, we're really mourning about all the national and personal tragedies that have ensued since the Churban, since the destruction. We have all these tragedies because we have the Siluk HaShchina. We're so far away from God. Tisha B'Av is the time, and we know people also focus in on the Holocaust on Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av is the time to mourn for the fact that if the Shechina of the Divine Presence is in Hester Panim, is in concealment, we have to suffer so greatly in life. Tisha B'Av is a time of mourning. It's a time of introspection of the Eicha Yashva Badad, how lonely we have sat, how in the dark we have sat with the Hester Panim. And Tisha B'Av is a time to cry over our personal and national tragedies that have befallen the Jewish people in our present day and age, in the situation in Eretz Yisrael, terrible tragedies we've witnessed over the past year. That's the Eicha Yashva Badad. That's the understanding of all the terrible things that have happened to us. But there's a second aspect to think about on Tisha B'Av. If the first aspect is the Eicha, is the recognition how alone we are, how in the dark we sit, the second aspect to think about on Tisha B'Av is the Ayeka, is where are we? And I think the question of where are we and what we need to focus in on is really modeled on the lesson that Kadosh Baruch Hu wanted to teach Adam HaRishon, going back to that original Medrash, after the expulsion from the Garden of Eden. We know that one of the punishments that Adam HaRishon got before he was expelled, that was to take place after the expulsion, is because you ate of the tree of which I commanded you not to eat, by the sweat of your brow you shall eat bread. We know that God's punishments are never acts of vengeance, but educational tools with the aim of rectifying the sin. Adam's sin was that he wanted to be acquainted with evil. In the spiritual state known as the Garden of Eden, only the spiritual has reality. By his sin, he thus excluded himself from Garden of Eden and lowered himself to a state called this world, the world of material existence in which nature and matter appear as real. Divine wisdom therefore decided that his remedy was to raise himself once again to see in his heart that nature is an illusion and that God's providence is real. This he was to do in the midst of working for his living in the world of nature. His work in the physical world continues, Rav Dessler, which all appearances be the pursuit of natural cause and effect, while in his heart he remained conscious of God's constant providence. This is what Adam HaRishon and subsequent mankind has been challenged with, to be able to see God in nature, to be able to see God in the hiddenness, to be able to see God in the darkness and not to get lost in confusion. In a real sense, this is what the Eicha, the Ayeka, is all about. It's a question of being able to see God, to apprehend God, and have a relationship with God. Let's try to develop this idea a little bit more deeper with an understanding of the perspective of the Churban Bayis Rishon, the destruction of the first and second temple. There's a wonderful essay by Rav Chaim Freelander in Sifsei Chaim, where he notes, as we saw before, that just to mourn over the temple is missing the essence of Tisha B'Av. The Avelus al Yushalayim Tovat Me'imanu, the mourning demands from us et tikun hapkamim shegamur l'chorbana. It demands from us to rectify the mistakes that we made that caused this destruction. Of course, we're upset and we're in the concept of mourning, but the mourning has to be a mitzvah pi'ila ha-mevi'ah lidei tota'ot chiyuviyot. The mourning has to lead to positive results. And the only way, he says, to really understand how to grow through the mourning is to see and to understand why the temple was destroyed and to be able to rectify those very things. So if we summarize what we've seen until now, and then we'll move further, is that we see very clearly from Rav Neventhal as well as from the Sifte Chaim that the mourning is not just over a physical building, it's not just mourning over what was, it's mourning over the fact that we as individuals, we as the Jewish people, have something within us that is not allowing the temple to be rebuilt. We're mourning our own spiritual problems, that we are so distant from God. And that is the perspective of the mourning. The mourning is not just on a building. That's so difficult to get ourselves into that mindset of a building we've never seen, a structure we have no ability to connect with. But we have to understand that it's much more personal than that. The fact that this building is not rebuilt, this building which represents the repository of God's closeness in this world, is because we ourselves have not built up ourselves to be on a level to be worthy of having this building. And therefore the mourning is a mourning over ourselves. It's a mourning for who we are not, what we lack spiritually in the fact that the temple hasn't been rebuilt. And therefore when we sit on Tisha B'Av, as the Chochma Musar said, and we hear Eicha, the lamentation of how could this possibly be, we have to also hear resonating within our minds, Ayeka, where are you? Where are you? How are you as an individual changing? How are you as an individual being a different person as a result of thinking about the Churban, thinking about the destruction? And yes, part of it is to realize the distance of God. And part of it is to focus in on the tragedies and the Eicha and how we sit alone. But the other part of Tisha B'Av, the part of the building of Tisha B'Av, so to speak, has to be the ayeka, the call of where are we? How are we changing ourselves? How are we able to do the proper introspection to grow as a result of the mourning period? And as Sifte Chaim notes, and here we will continue, it's at this point, that it's only through understanding why the temple was destroyed that we can perhaps work on rectifying those very issues and being able to respond in our own lives to the ayeka of where are we in regard to these issues. And we quote the Gemara in Yuma, which we're familiar with, for what was the first temple destroyed? For the three cardinal sins that were rampant then, idolatry, sexual morality, and murder. But in the time of the second temple, the Jews kept busy studying Torah and performing mitzvot and doing acts of kindness. For what then was it destroyed? Because of their unwarranted hatred of each other. For this one may learn that unwarranted hatred is as great a sin as idolatry, morality, and murder altogether. When one looks at this Gemara on face value, and one compares the first temple period to the second temple period, our gut reaction may be that the first temple period was far worse than the second temple period. The first temple period, they committed these major cardinal sins. The second temple period, it's not so nice to hate people, but it's only unwarranted hatred. It's not these major sins. And yet, we know based on our Chazal, and based on history as well, is that the first Beis HaMikdash was rebuilt 70 years later. The exile was only for 70 years. This exile is going on for thousands of years. And that's the biggest proof that the first temple period was not as severe as the sins of the second temple period. How do we characterize the difference between the two? So the Vilna Gaon, the Gra, has a wonderful explanation. He says, V'hatam ki arishonim hayu ma'aseim hatovim tmunim v'avanaseim gluyim. The first temple period, the people were very good at heart. They had good deeds deep within them, but their sins were very rampant on the external level. But kilibam hayato, but the heart was basically good. V'achronim lahefech, and the second temple period was exact opposite. V'rachmana liba bayit, what God really desires, what God really wants, is a person's heart. And the Sifti Chaim develops it. And he says, the first temple period, within their deepest part, hayu chadurei bitachon v'emunah b'Hashem, they had faith in God. They had a relationship with God. And that's why they really thought, as we mentioned earlier, they'd be protected by the temple, because basically they were believing Jews. And they recognized that when they went off, they recognized this, and hence they were able to do tshuva, and the exile period was a short period. We ask ourselves, says the Sifti Chaim, if you want to tell me that im libam shel rishonim bepnimuteim haya tov, in essence they were good, chadurei emunah v'bitachon, they were full of faith and emuna in God, haketzad nichshelu bavonot kol chamurim kavadat zarat gilui arayos v'shvichos damim, how are you then to explain that they were involved in these three tremendous terrible sins? What do you mean that inside they were good and outside they weren't so good? But look at what they did outside. They did terrible sins. How are we to explain? How are we to say that really these people weren't as bad as the second temple period? These sins seem pretty bad. So explains the Sifti Chaim, and this is the key, based on Rabbi Yisrael Salanter in the Geras HaMusar. He says there are two types of a Yetzer Hara, two types of evil inclination. Yetzer Hara tivi, one is a natural Yetzer Hara. It's the taivas, it's the desires that are tvuot bo, that are deeply ingrained in a person. And then there's the Yetzer Hara ruchani. There's a spiritual Yetzer Hara. There's a koach tuma, a spiritual impurity. It's like a malach or a satan that puts a person off the right track, that entices a person to do averus, and explains that with the first Beis HaMikdash, the people were really good. That Yetzer Hara TV, that natural Yetzer Hara, did not exist within them. They were basically good people who were able to work on that natural Yetzer Hara, to work on those taivos, and they really were able to reach a high spiritual level. What was the problem? The problem was, it was the outer Yetzer Hara Ruchani. It was that spiritual outer force that enticed them off the correct path, that caused them to do Avara Zara, Giloy Arayos, and Shvichos Damim. It wasn't that their essence was corrupt. Their essence was fine. It was an outer manifestation. It wasn't really who they were at the core that moved them off the right path. The second generation of the second Beis HaMikdash was exact opposite. They, by essence, had corrupt values. Inside, internally, they had the Yetzirah TV, the natural Yetzirah. And that's the difference between the first Beis HaMikdash and the second Beis HaMikdash. It's the second Beis HaMikdash. It's the symptomatic of that Yetzirah TV, the desires, that negativity found within, part and parcel of a person, that we're still struggling with until today. And it's this Yetzirah, it's this problem that I think we need to try to understand a little bit more deeply, because this is the Ayeka, this is the mourning that we as individuals. A wonderful insight about the difference between the two Batei Mikdash, the two generations, based on the concept of the kosher and non-kosher animals. And he says in 27, a kosher animal has two signs of its kashrut. It chews its cud and its hooves are cloven. These two signs have a common element. They are a clear indication that this is not a beast of prey and that's content with its lot. A hunting animal does not chew its cud since it eats no vegetable matter and meat is digestible without rumination. Once the prey is digested, the predator seeks new food, ever discontent and ravenous, whereas a ruminant is content with whatever is already in its stomach and makes it do double service. A hunting animal possesses claws with which to tear its victims apart. A kosher animal is satisfied with the food its creator brings forth from the ground. And the commentators explain that non-kosher animals are forbidden as food because eating them subtly influences man towards the undesirable characteristics of a beast of prey. And this is the key. And this, my friends, is really the key of Vaisheni. Discontent with one's lot and the resultant exploitation of other creatures. Nothing is more antithetical to spiritual health than these character traits. Dissatisfaction with one's lot stems from a lack of true faith in God's providence. Now, we understand that all non-kosher animals nearly lack both of these signs. The Torah details just four animals that have one sign but lack the other: the camel, the rabbit, the hare, and the pig. The first three chew their cud but do not have cloven hooves. The last, the pig, has cloven hooves but does not chew its cud. And explains what's the difference. The first three animals have the internal sign of chewing the cud but not the external one. Thus they represent the various manifestations of a frustrated spiritual nature when one's inner essence is amenable to holiness but is prevented from realizing itself by one's inappropriate external behavior. If one's behavior is exploitative of others, then one's hooves, his outer nature, has become claws, even though one's inner nature remains potentially ruminant, i.e. satisfied with its lot. But the fourth animal, the pig, has the external signs of kashrut but not the internal one. Thus it represents a worse form of impurity. A person whose outer behavior is expressive of holiness, but who inwardly denies the dominion of God. This person has cloven hooves instead of claws, but his inner nature is that of a beast of prey. Claws would suit him better. And explains so beautifully that the four forms of spiritual impurity which these animals represent the four great kingdoms. The first three, seeking wealth, self-aggrandizement, and at the expense of others, but within their hearts they believed in God and His providence. The Roman Empire, however, displayed all the external signs of commitment to spirituality on the surface. It was civilized, looked after human welfare, preached justice and human rights, but inwardly it believes in nothing but self-worship. And here, as Rabbi Yochanan points out, the earlier generations, says Rabbi Yochanan, suffered from serious evil in their external behavior, but in their hearts they acknowledged God's kingship. It was simply they could not govern their lust. Later generations led a satisfactory external life, but their society was filled with clandestine hatred and jealousy because their hearts were rotten with selfishness and the resultant denial of God's dominion in human life. And this, my friends, is really the key. The key difference between Bayis Rishon and Bayis Sheni are these animals. The external, the ones who are internally fine, but externally no good, and the one pig who is externally fine, but internally no good. And it's this aspect of the denial of God's dominion in human life is basically the characteristic of the challenge that we have. We are on the outside, we are look like everything's fine, and we're very involved in Torah and Yerushalayim and mitzvot, but the question is the core, who we are, at the root of who we are, do we have this bitachon, this faith in God, do we have this relationship with God? And there are two very important corollaries that come from this. In having a lack of real bitachon, of real faith in God, leans to one of two or sometimes both results. One, continuing in the juggler and the king, they did not really trust that he would provide them with their needs, and imagine that man was alone in charge of his fate. Worst of all, they believed that any other human being was a potential threat to their own success, and thus made him the object of their hatred. And inevitably, the selfishness created a society of mutual competition which penetrated to the individual level. The ambitions of each individual for mastery and control over others caused him to see others' existence as a threat to the fulfillment of his own goals. This ambition caused Jews to begin to hate one another with an unwarranted hatred which had no cause except resentment of the other's existence. And the Sifti Chaim develops this further by saying, it's an idea we've spoken about at length, that if you really believe and have real bitachon and emunah in God, then you know that every situation that is given to a person is tailor-made for that person. And the kochos and the strengths and the quality traits and the characteristics that we have and who we are given to us because this is our chelik, this is our service of God. If a person deep down has this relationship and bitachon and this faith with God, then he has no room to be jealous of others. He has no room to desire that which another person has, because he understands so clearly that every person, using the mushal of eyeglasses, has a prescription that fits their eyes perfectly. And to want another person's prescription for eyeglasses is silly, because you can't look at the world through another person's lenses, another person's prescription. That is what life is about. On the first level, to really understand and have a relationship of bitachon, to work on the internal quality, not what is found on the outside and the behavior on the outside, but the mindset of a Jew. The first question of Ayeka, of where are you, is do you really believe that your life is that which God has tailor-made for you? Do you believe that the parts of the play are given to you based on your kochos hanefesh, based on that which makes you unique and makes you special? This is the question we have to ask ourselves. If we have this hatred, why did this guy get this promotion and I didn't get it? And how come so-and-so has this and I don't have that? And we spend our whole lives looking at other people, then we fail to listen to Ayeka, where are you? Where are you means that you have to deal with a personal relationship with God. Your concern is not what the other person has to deal with in their life. The concern has to be Ayeka, what you have to deal with in your own life. And if you understand that everything is given to you, which is what you need, then there's no room for sinas chinam, no room for unwarranted hatred. Unwarranted hatred is symptomatic of a lack of bitachon, a lack of faith in God. Continues the Gra. The second problem that comes as a result of this lack of emunah and bitachon is chemda, is desire. When Chavakuk put all of Judaism on one foot when he said, "V'tzadik b'emunato yichyeh," a righteous person lives in his emunah. Emunah, faith, is exact opposite of chemda, of desire. The midah of histapkut, being satisfied with what one has, that everything that God has given you is a gift from God. And this leads us to the second aspect of what comes as a result of not having bitachon in God. And that's the Gemara Yerushalmi in Yuma, where our sages say, and this is based on Rabbi Foyer's essay in Seasons of the Soul, for their love for money, they came to hate one another. But the reason why there's the Beis Hamikdash being destroyed was the concept of the love of money. And Rav Feuer develops this, and he says, this answer touches on man's basic nature, for man compared to most lesser creatures is almost totally lacking in natural defenses and desperately craves for a sense of safety and security. Men are powerfully drawn to whatever seems to promise them protection and insurance. In the time of the First Temple, pagan forces impressed many Jews as being their guardian angels, and they placed their confidence in Avodah Zarah. And we know that the destruction of the First Temple shook the people back to their senses. But the attraction of Avodah Zarah continued to taunt them, and they felt too weak to withstand it. And we know rabbis tell us that the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, the men of the Great Assembly, took drastic and extraordinary action. They prayed that this Yetzer Hara, this evil inclination, be eradicated from their passions and their hearts. And this unusual request was granted. But Rabbi Feuer notes that this temptation has to be given another temptation in its place so that there is a balance between the attraction of good and evil. And he quotes the Ari HaKadosh as well as others, the Chidah, who tell us that the desire for money took its place. This desire for possessing money provided insatiable an appetite impossible to still. Even if a man's needs be few, his possessions, no matter how vast, never seem sufficient. As the Medrash tells us, going to call us Rabbah, he who possesses 100 desires 2, he who possesses 200 desires 4. This is what life is all about now. It's about the desire for money, the desire for what we think is security. Man's true source of security, he continues, should be with his Creator. His bitachon should be with his Creator. God is boundless, and so is his protection boundless. No security can compare with this. But man in his foolishness has transferred his account. He has withdrawn from God and has deposited his faith with his funds and his finances. It follows that to replace the boundless protective Creator, he must forever seek endless, unlimited supplies of money. Thus did the sages comment, man does not die with even half of his desires in his grasp. And this explains a little bit more deeply when the Gemara says, on account of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, Jerusalem was destroyed. We know the very famous story of how the wrong individual was invited to the party. He came to the party, was humiliated, and therefore set up a trap so that the Jews would be implicated against the government and ultimately led to destruction of the temple. While this tragic tale of intense hatred is well known, it is interesting to note that Kamsan, literally means a miser whose fist is clamped over his coins. It was this obsession with money that aroused men to horrible feuds and bitter vendettas. And it's not by accident that we know that in the Second Temple period, the position, the most special spiritual position of the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, was then sold to the highest bidder. And the high priest in turn misused his power to enhance his personal standing. We find that the downfall of the Second Temple was a downfall that had very much to do with money, with power, with possession, and not putting one's bitachon in God. And he notes, ideally we should recognize our utter dependence on God, and whether penniless or endowed with a generous abundance of resources, we should conceive of every cent we possess as bread from his table. Any measure of affluence should be understood as a divine trust for us to execute with responsibility and fealty to his wishes. It reminds me of a lesson that I learned from a taxi driver in Israel. Sometimes taxi drivers in Israel can teach you greater lessons than you can read in books. The taxi driver who did not have a kippah on his head, who would not fit into the external trappings of what we speak about as a religious person, he drove us back from the biblical zoo, and we got into a discussion with him. We were couple of days shy away from our return trip to the state. We're talking about Los Angeles. Has he ever been to Los Angeles? No, he's never been outside of Israel. Doesn't he have a desire to go travel, to live outside? All these Israelis that are found in Los Angeles, how they make big money. So he said to us with utter simplicity, he says, God is found everywhere in the world. And God takes care of every person's needs, exactly that which they need. He says, I have as a taxi driver in Israel all that I need to be able to support myself and my family. And I know that wherever I am, God will provide for me. Why do I need to go to the States and get money there when God can provide for me equally as well here? It's this utter simplicity of God providing for a person that what we're talking about. It's this real bitachon, it's this real faith in God. And as Rabbi Foyer continues, he says, failing this, God resorts to tactics of shock to awaken us to the bankruptcy of the faith we have invested in our own powers of self-support. He then shakes the confidence we have placed in our bulging coffers and fat bank accounts. Depression, recession, inflation, devaluation, price squeeze, profit squeeze, wage slash, stock market slips, unemployment rise, petrodollars, gold crates, soaring taxes, all of these elements of economic instability have a definite purpose and are part of a divine plan. Our rabbis tell us with great emphasis that the confusion, the anarchy, and the audacity that marked the era preceding Mashiach's arrival are designed to shake our self-confidence and to make us realize we have no one to lean on except our Father in Heaven. It's not by accident that Zechariah describes the Mashiach himself as coming empty-handed. Ani v'rochev al chamor, a pauper riding on a donkey. Gemara Sanhedrin says the son of David, the Mashiach, will not come until the penny vanishes from the purse. Only then will we hear the footfalls. Only then will our mourning turn to joy, and will the ruins of the temple be rebuilt. And I think that this is really what the Ayeka is about. If we see in summary that the mourning of Tisha B'Av is a mourning, yes, for the state of Eicha, the state of lamentation, how we've moved away from the Garden of Eden, and we have to suffer from Hester Panim, from God's hiddenness. And part of Tisha B'Av is mourning our personal national tragedies that are a result of this Hester Panim, the result of this Eicha. But there's a second part of Tisha B'Av. The second part of Tisha B'Av is to hear the Ayeka, to hear the voice of where are we. That we're not just mourning a building that once was. We're not just mourning a state that once was. We're mourning over ourselves that we have not been able to come back and recreate that state, to recreate that nearness with God. Tisha B'Av has to be a day of growth. Kara Lai Moed. The Navi says it's a day of Moed, a day of a festival. And as we've seen before, Rav Wolbe describes this as a Moed Shariachuk. It's a festival of distance. The moment you recognize how far we are from God, the moment that we're able to hear that call of Ayeka, where are we? That is a moment of rejoicing. That is the positive aspect. That's the birth of the Mashiach, so to speak, as described on Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av is not only a day of passivity, of mourning. It's a day very much of constructive movement forward as a fast of tshuva, of repentance. In what respect do we have to repent? What is the call of Ayeka? What is the call of where are we that we have to hear? It has to be, as the Sifti Chaim note, to rectify the sins, the problems that led to the Chorban. And the problems that led to the second Chorban of Beis HaMikdash was not the outer aspect. The people were frum, and they kept Torah mitzvot, and they were involved in chesed. But the question is, where is the core, the model of the pig? Where is the essence of what a Jew is all about? That's the question that we need to ask ourselves on Tisha B'Av. Yes, we daven, and yes, we're careful about the finest hashgachas on what we eat. But where are we, push comes to shove, in our closeness to God? In our feeling in davening, in our feeling in eating, in our elevation, in our mitzvot, in our whole relationship with God? And if we really were understood and worked on that aspect of Amunah and Bitachon, and it really filled us to the core. It was our Pnimius. It was our internal nature then we'd be able to work on one of, or two, or both major afflictions that afflict us. One is to be satisfied with our lot, the hallmark of the kosher animal, to understand that what God has given us is that which we need in order to serve Him, and therefore the sinas chinam, this unwarranted hatred, has no place, because we understand that that which we need is what God gives us. And the second aspect, which is so important in our day and age as well, is to be able to appreciate our reliance on God in the monetary sphere as well, and not to put all of our hope and all of our faith in our bank accounts, in our financial schemes, but to really see that God has a hand in running our lives as well. The lesson that Adam HaRishon had to learn, that God is the one who apportions out from Rosh Hashanah to Rosh Hashanah what our bank account is all about. And that we have to understand that if we really have a relationship with God and we really want to bring God into our lives, so we have to allow God into this sphere as well, to understand that He knows exactly how much we need, not a penny more and not a penny less. And that He is the one who's directing this aspect of our lives. And the more we want to hold on to this, and the more we shut God out of this, the more we are closing our ears to the Ayeka, where are you? Tisha B'Av is asking us, deep, deep down, do you let God into your life? Do you make God a personal God on your everyday level? When the small instances in life come up where things don't go the way you'd like them to go, and the natural jealousy creeps in, are you able to step back and hold on to that bitachon, hold on to that faith, hold on to that relationship with God? And if we're able to at least be cognizant that these are areas that we have to work on, we have to work on being appreciative of our lot, of understanding this is what God has laid out and set up for us. The more we can focus on this, the more we can develop this, the more we are then being able to mourn over our spiritual situation. And the mourning is not just a negative type of mourning, it's a positive type of mourning that's allowing us to rebuild ourselves. And as we rebuild ourselves in our relationship with God and allowing God to rest much more within our lives, we are ultimately rebuilding the larger Beis HaMikdash, allowing God to reside among the Jewish people.